You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Katrin Sigurðardóttir. She is an Icelandic artist and, among other things, represented Iceland in the 55th Venice Biennial. Katrin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Brainerd.
To begin with, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now. I'm really a big fan of your work, and I like what you're doing and how you're thinking. What's happening in your studio now, or what are you working on?
Thank you. I am just sort of coming back to my practice after this large project that I did for the Venice Biennial. In the last weeks and months, I have been doing a lot of sort of following up on after the Biennale, giving lectures and making public appearances, and I've done a lot of travel in relation to this, and now I'm sort of finally settling back into my studio, which is of course really wonderful and brings back my peace and happiness. I'm working on several large institutional projects. The most immediate one is going to be at the Reykjavik Art Museum in Iceland, and it opens in January of 2014. It's the second chapter in this trilogy of exhibition that began in Venice. It's the work from Venice reinstalled in the architecture of the Harbour House Museum in Reykjavik. And from there, the piece goes to Sculpture Center, where it will open in June of 2014. And it might appear that these would be sort of more straightforward touring of an exhibition from one location to the next, but in fact these three exhibitions are all kind of unique because the work kind of changes every time it's exhibited, every time it intersects with a new architecture, it changes form in certain ways. So there's been quite a bit of work leading up to the exhibition in Venice and in Reykjavik. I've been working with a team of architects in Reykjavik, which has been very, very fun. And then I will do the same thing for Sculpture Center in the spring. The show at Sculpture Center is scheduled to open probably on the 1st of June. After that, I'm also currently preparing a show at MIT in Boston, where I'll be working with Paul Haaf on an exhibition that opens in either fall of 2014, fall or winter 2014. And then following that is an exhibition at the Parasol Unit, Foundation for Contemporary Art in London, in summer of 2015. I'm also working on a book project, an interesting book project in Italy, and I'm doing some proposals for public artworks, and I am working on also some editions for Sculpture Center and for the Icelandic Art Center, which commissioned the show in Venice and the Reykjavik Art Museum. So this is kind of the, you know, this is all on my plate right now in the studio. The project in Venice and the sort of last major project before that were both very large scale works. The project I'm referring to are the two sculptures I did at the Metropolitan Museum in 2010. And I'm really enjoying sort of going back to a more object-based process in my studio and some smaller works that I'm just sort of working on alone in the studio along with some work on paper as well. So I'm generally happiest when I can be active in, you know, all of these categories, and that's what's going on right now.
It's very exciting. I mean, that's a pretty full schedule, and I imagine that, you know, I know the work in Venice and saw that, and that was a gorgeous show, and I imagine that as you're talking about going around and installing all of this, there's an enormous amount of collaboration with what you're doing in constructing and working with other builders and architects. Is that correct? Because it looks like there's so much detailed construction, and as you're saying, kind of reconstruction and rebuilding with each one. Is that, are you working with kind of a team of people to help you build all those things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, works like these, they will never come to exist unless you work with a team of people. And the work that I did in Venice, I have not actually fully counted the number of people who came together to make that possible, but they were, you know, they fill, as it is right now, I think they fill more than a page in the catalog that we published for the show. Most significantly, of course, are the two curators that I worked with, Ilaria Bonacossa and Mary Cerruti, and the commissioner, Dorothea Kirch, and now, as of late, Þórodur Bjarnason. And it was a really wonderful collaboration of between people in Iceland, between people in Italy, between people here in New York. And I worked with a great architect in Venice named Charles Brun, an engineer named Maurizio Milan, and you know, it's a project on this scale is kind of like, you know, building a house. And so for me, this is surely the most monumental work that I have made. And this work just is entirely possible through, you know, the great support I got from so many people.
And, you know, it seems extraordinary that you're also able to work with all of those people when architects typically, perhaps not typically, but often when architects are working with a team of people who are builders and constructing, sometimes there's miscommunication or it's difficult and things can't be realized the way the architect wanted. You're working in such a creative, and I don't know if fluid is the right word, but you know, the manner that I imagine you're working with this huge team, which seems hard to imagine. It's like, maybe it's like building a house. It seems more like making a film to me. There's so many people.
Or running for public office.
So do you find it easy to work with a team like that? Is that part of what gives you, you know, maybe not pleasure in it, but is it something that works for you seamlessly, as opposed to what I would imagine often happens with architects, which is, you know, disagreements and misunderstandings and all kinds of things that can go between the designer, so to speak, and so many people who are building?
Well, I think, you know, the creative process, or at least my creative process, is always a bit of a sort of a flux between working solitarily and working with a group. And I am always, when I'm working with people, I'm always very appreciative of the fact that I'm working with people, because there is a level of expertise that is needed that I couldn't possibly have. And I also really enjoy the collective process and the social process. And for example, in the most immediate sense, when we you know, there's of course there are layers upon layers in the production of a work like this. You know, applying for permits, going through technical details in the conception of the work. But then there's also, as you saw in Venice, the work is comprised of about 9,000 handmade tiles. I had a group of about, probably altogether about 10 people, 10 young artists who worked with me in making that. And we, I mean, it's really probably one of the most enjoyable times that I've ever had in my studio was when we were all working together making those tiles. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, when you finish a project of this magnitude, you're also very happy to go back to, you know, making a small sculpture that you can actually pick up in its entirety with two hands and you work on alone. So it's just, you know, I feel very fortunate because I, you know, I've had the opportunity to do both and to, you know, and to also do my drawings and you know, the best, it's kind of the best of all worlds to be able to.
It sounds wonderful. I'd like to talk a little bit about Iceland. I mean, this is an amazing kind of time for you. It sounds a very vital time, a kind of mature time for your art. You're doing such, you know, massive collaborations as well as, you know, prestigious ones that are getting a lot of attention and obviously keeping you enormously busy moving around the world. Growing up in Iceland, which I'm fascinated by and want to talk about in a number of ways, but how do you think that began to shape your art process? And was there a time when you were younger that you imagine or that you remember first getting engaged in art and being interested in it?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of set my eyes and my mind on art when I was very young. I was started taking art classes both as part of my, you know, elementary education and also in this, at the Art Academy of Iceland, where I later was a professor. I started taking classes when I was 6 or 7 years old. And I was very lucky in that there was a lot of, there were a lot of artists around me when I was growing up, both poets and musicians, concert musicians, and people who are involved in theater, and visual artists, and I would say in a certain way that there was the saturation of art in my surroundings was, as you know, was really comparable to what it is today when I'm working as a professional artist. So, and you know, I'm one of these people who just set my mind in the very beginning on being an artist, and I've really never changed my mind. And you know, every decision I've made pretty much in my life since very early has been kind of geared towards this objective. And what this means also is that, you know, I was kind of studying art in a very traditional way from a very early age, and that I've sort of reflected back on that a little bit lately, and I think that you know, there's something to be said for my interest in kind of the historical continuity between sort of contemporary and non-contemporary, that I think comes very much out of that, out of my, you know, being so kind of fascinated and in love with, you know, art from previous times before, you know, really having a sense of the contemporary, I could say. And I was accepted, you know, after taking art classes through elementary school and high school. I mean, school system in Iceland is a little bit different than here, so it's not really you know, when I say high school, it's not exactly like high school in the U.S., but after finishing high school, I took an exam to be accepted to the Art Academy, and I was 15 or 16 years old, and I was accepted. And thankfully, I had a mentor as a young person in Iceland who was the father of my best friend, still my best friend, and his name was Hörður Ágústsson, and he's a very significant Icelandic artist who studied in Paris in the late 40s, and kind of bridges the gap between abstract expressionism or geometric abstraction and then the sort of process-based conceptual art of the 60s and the 70s in Iceland. And I think he recognized that I was just, you know, despite my enthusiasm and lack of patience for, you know, going full on into art, he recognized that I was a little bit too young, and I went to a college and studied Latin and Greek for 4 years, and then after that I went to went to the Art Academy in Reykjavik, where I studied for 2 years. I studied in a program there which was called the Living Arts Department, which was founded by Dieter Roth, and Hörður was involved as well. Hörður and Dieter collaborated quite a bit in Iceland, and Hörður was sort of the bridge that brought Dieter into the Society of Icelandic Artists when he first moved to Iceland. But anyway, I was there for a couple of years, and then kind of went on a short trip to San Francisco to visit friends in San Francisco, and that kind of pulled me out of a certain sequence of events in Iceland and into another sequence of events in San Francisco, and that was in 1988, and that's sort of when I left Iceland and then has lived for the most part in the U.S. since then.
And it sounds like, you know, an incredible kind of growing up there in Iceland, you know, especially, you know, having a mentor like that. And, you know, here it's kind of unheard of to also have 2 years of studying Latin and Greek. I mean, that happens, but it's not, that's usually in private schools or in college, if you're in literature, the humanities. What was the influence of that, and why did you choose that? Was that mandatory, or was that part of the process of school?
No, I think it was my sort of I think I was interested in a faraway world in some sense. Looking into historical art, and I think of the time that I was studying classics very much as a time where I was just kind of, in some ways, very much on kind of floating around on my own ancient planet, you know, very sort of disconnected from, from maybe the sort of life that a lot of young people my age were having in Iceland. And I'm very interested in, you know, I love systems, I love language. And in a sense, you know, Icelandic is another kind of ancient language. And to study Latin and Greek is also a way of coming to understand is coming to understand the syntax and the architecture of my own language better. And I think that studying these languages has seemingly no kind of apparent sort of aid or help in my life today, but I think it is an incredible foundation, and I think it's kind of fundamental very much to how I think and how I articulate things. So I'm very happy to have had that as part of my rearing in Iceland.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. And then you said so you moved to the United States, and that was more or less a permanent move.
Yeah, I was at the art school in Iceland, and feeling, you know, kind of continuing with my lack of patience for, you know, being thoroughly immersed with art and the world beyond Iceland, I transferred to the San Francisco Art Institute, and there I was studying mainly painting and experimental film. So the school that I was in, or the department I was in Iceland, was very sort of new genre based and based in performance and conceptual art. And I kind of shifted a little bit when I went to the Art Institute for, you know, reasons that were somewhat practical. And at the Art Institute, I studied with some of the people that are most memorable to me are Sam Chukalian, who was a wonderful painter, Bay Area expressionist painter, and the filmmaker Abigail Child, who is a New Yorker, and I have, you know, stayed in touch with her through the years. And after I finished the Art Institute, I, you know, did what, you know, many of us do. We, you know, after art school, went to intern at, you know, galleries or art institutions. And I also worked as an artist assistant for some years for an artist whose name was William Gatewood, who passed away from AIDS in the early 90s, and whose career and life was cut short by that tragedy. And of course, living in San Francisco at this time was, you know, one was kind of surrounded by this reality on all sides. And but I was very, you know, feel very fortunate to have been brought into his family, and gotten to know him and his life and his work. And I think his work was of a very, there was a very strong decorative element, and also a really strong kind of quotation to the decorative arts, I would say, historically, in his work. And my job in his studio was very much to work on his limited editions and some of his murals and stuff like that. And I think I've been reflecting back on that, especially when I was working on my two pieces at the Met in 2010, because I was in a sense replicating the, or sort of putting myself in the shoe of the decorative artisan. And I just thought of it recently that perhaps there's some kind of, you know, link between this this time and this process and the work that I did then. And and then after being in San Francisco for about 5 years, I went to I kind of made a sudden move to New York, and I was on my way to go to graduate school in California, and then I just changed everything and decided to go to New York, and went to graduate school at Rutgers in New Jersey, and studied there with Martha Rostler and Joan Semmel and Greg Jeffrey Hendricks. Those were my sort of three main main guides during my graduate school. But actually, I should kind of backtrack a little bit to San Francisco before I leave, the West Coast completely, to say that in San Francisco is also where I had my first solo exhibition in 1992, I believe it was. And in San Francisco is also where I met Mary Cerruti. I was an intern at Park Street Project for a while, and Mary, I think, was, you know, relatively new there, and so was I, and so I just was so happy when, you know, about 10 years later, I re-met her in New York, and just wonderful to have that kind of, you know, have memories from, you know, beautiful San Francisco in the 90s with Mary. But anyway, so going back to New York, I graduated from Rutgers in 1995, and went to and in 1997 is when I had my first exhibition in Iceland.
So after graduating school, then you had that exhibition in Iceland, and I know you had been exhibiting somewhat before then, but can you tell me about that? That almost sounds like a kind of coming home, and must have been important because now you're out of school. So how did that exhibition differ from what you had been doing before then, or the shows you had before then?
Well, when I finished undergrad in San Francisco, I was always very clear that I wanted to take several years between graduate school and or between undergrad and graduate school, and I was actively showing during that time. And then after I finished graduate school and went and worked on an exhibition in Iceland, which opened at the Living Art Museum in 1997, that was, yeah, maybe in some sense it was, surely it was an exhibition that had more exposure than the ones that I had done before. But the Living Art Museum in Iceland is a very special institution with an incredible history, which, like many other posts in Iceland, carry Dieter Roth's name somewhere on their pages. And this was actually, I remember at the time in another part of the museum was an exhibition of Anna Mendieta. So I don't think, I think at the time I didn't realize what, you know, significant company I was in. But it was an exhibition that...
Was that the green grass of home? Was that what that was?
No. This was quite a bit earlier than that. I was beginning to work on that piece around the same time, but that body of work I didn't start to show until some years later. At the same time, I was also working on, I was also in an exhibition that traveled to Switzerland, Zurich, and I met a lot of interesting people there, and some of them I have continued to stay in contact with, like Beatrix Ruf, who I this last summer also did a conference with in Switzerland. And but the exhibition in 97 in Iceland was sort of, I was fairly, I think, unknown and sort of unmapped to people in Iceland up to that point. And that sort of, there was a certain sequence that I was sort of pulled back into from that point on, I would say.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those works. I mean, and I know, you know, the works that I've seen from 98 and 97, and the ones that involved landscape and model making, and those seem different from the other works, but of course part of them, and it asked the question for me, you know, also about landscape in Iceland, landscape in general. But one thing that I've always thought and wondered about Iceland, and I remember this from the one time I visited there, and I don't know if this is true or something of a kind of myth, but that highways and roads in Iceland were occasionally rerouted to go around areas where gnomes were known to have lived. Is that accurate and true?
Well, you know, I can't really, I can't comment too much on, you know, on sort of the, you know, I'm not a historian in that sense to be able to really validate, you know, to be able
where
to
the
validate
roads have
that
been
or
rerouted,
not. Yeah, but in my own work, I think people very often see, you know, the sort of occurrence of landscape in my work to be about, to be as a way to kind of illustrate Iceland. And, you know, most of the works that I have done that deal with landscape were not made in Iceland. In 1999, I went on a residency in Norway, and many of these landscape works sort of began there. Some of them also began in California and in San Francisco and in New York. And my interest in landscape is I always think of my own identity as being very formed by the fact that I have sort of lived in many topographies, and when I'm working with landscape, I'm working with it as almost like a sort of as an environment to my identity. And I often play with the sort of diffusion of different landscapes. So, for example, many of the boxed landscapes I've made, they are not a specific landscape. They are often a mixture of, let's say, a landscape in California and in Norway and in Iceland. And it's similar as if you wake up and you've had a dream and you know in the dream you were in a certain place, you were in a certain, by a certain mountain, but then when you start to describe the mountain, you realize that the mountain that you saw in the dream is not the mountain that you believe, you know, where you were. So there's this kind of discrepancy between, you know, a factual account and the perception. And I feel that in many of my past works, I've been dealing with less with a particular topography or less with a particular landscape and more with the way we perceive landscape and the way we perceive ourselves in landscape. So, the point I'm making is that I personally never have set out to illustrate a particular place, and especially having lived in California and having spent quite a bit of time in Switzerland also and in the Italian Alps, you know, it's more about the picturesque and it's more about the idyllic sense of the landscape than it is about a particular place. I think there's a piece I did in Iceland in 2004 which is more abstract, which maybe deals more specifically with Icelandic landscape. But it is about being engulfed in landscape and also seeing it from a distance. I don't know if
that doesn't make sense. But it isn't, you know, directly related to that. When I was interviewing Gregory Volk, who was talking a lot about Iceland, of course, you know, there's something about Iceland for coming from New York, coming from the States, that seems magnetic and very unusual somehow. That's hard for Gregory or myself to really put a handle on. And you know, you're being influenced by all these different landscapes, of course. It just seemed that there was something, you know, that there's this kind of, I don't know how to put it, but there's something very unusual about what's happening in Iceland. And there's a landscape there, and maybe landscape is the wrong word, but there's a way of life. The fact that there's, you know, not that many people on this land mass, and a number of things geologically that seem to make it kind of otherworldly, at least to Americans or to Gregory Volk and other people. Is that something you don't see there, or is...
No. I mean, I think there's always a difference between how you experience a place when you come from within it and from when you see it from the outside and when you come from the outside. And I think that my work actually, you know, I think that's something that I try to deal with in my work. And I'm in no way trying to somehow negate that in my work. Of course, my work is a depiction partially. It's a, you know, I'm very concerned, especially in my earlier work about landscape, which is like, you know, fusion and contrast and conflation between fiction and memory, and you know how these things mix together. I think that I just see Iceland, you know, Iceland is like, you know, Iceland is the place where I grew up. It's the, you know, it's the language that I speak, it's where my family is, and all of this, you know, makes me see Iceland with, you know, through a certain commonality and not through kind of a phenomenal, you know, frame, let's say. I mean, I don't experience it that way, but it's very possible that, you know, that's something that, you know, other people see in my work. But there is a lot of people who obviously are making, you know, who look at Iceland, but they, you know, we all look at Iceland from a different perspective because of our histories and where we come from. And I mean, I think, I believe that in a sense, you know, what you see is what is in you, you know. And I think, for example, in High Plain, this work that I did several years ago, you know, that's a landscape that is based very specifically, or I mean, the mountains that I was looking at when I was making that were mountains in Norway. But I knew all the while that I wasn't making specifically the Norwegian mountains. You know, there's also boxes that I've made where I've been looking specifically at the Alps. But they are just kind of like, you know, a generic prototype that I use when I work.
Right. That's
there is a level of trickery in it. You know, there's a level of trickery about, you know, then when people look at these blue, you know, islands or these blue mountains, they think, oh, you know, I there was a fisherman in Iceland that came and saw the show, and he said, these are surely the cliffs of the Faroe Islands rising from the sea, you know. And And somebody else says, oh, but this is like, you know, the Canadian, you know, a mountain ridge in Canada. And somebody else says, oh, it must be the Alps. And somebody who, but then there's sort of the common assumption that all of this, of course, is Iceland. But this is, I think, part of our, you know, it is part of our own sense of perception, our own you know, passion and love for the imaginary. And, you know, it's just, I think it's all quite fascinating. And it's something that I was very, you know, concerned with working with for a certain period of time.
Yeah, I think that's a great example too of that piece, High Plane. That's where people are coming up on those ladders and looking onto that other landscape in the air. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's an installation that I was making sort of over a 6 or 7 year period. Beginning, I showed it for the first time in Iceland in 2001, and then showed it actually in an exhibition that Gregory Volk and Sabina Roos curated here in New York in 2001. No, I'm sorry, that was in 2002. And then that's a piece that went on to be shown at the Renaissance Society in Chicago and TS1 and a few other places.
So talking about that part of the arc of your career, where was the time when, you know, you came to San Francisco and you were working other jobs and assistants? Was there a moment in your career where there was a departure from that and you no longer had to work those jobs and were only working in your studio and making art?
Yes. Like I said, I did this residency in Norway, a year-long residency in Norway in 1999, I think. And then that was sort of a time when I was considering a little bit, like, you know, this 10-year period of my academic work in San Francisco and Iceland was had come to an end. And I was kind of considering if I was going back, you know, to Iceland or going back to New York. And I decided to go back to New York. And then I took a job for some years as a designer, and I was working as a graphic designer in New York, which was really a fantastic time that I often think back on and like very much. And during the same time, I was also showing quite actively. In Norway, I had met a curator named Jonas Ekeberg, who curated me in a biennale in Norway called Momentum, which was, this was in 2000. And in the same year, I was also included in an exhibition at the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C., a historical overview of Icelandic art dealing with, specifically works dealing with nature. And it was, I think, Ólafur Eliasson and I, who we were born in the same year, and we were the two youngest participants in that exhibition. And then sort of following this, I received an artist grant from Iceland, and that's when I sort of really made the decision, okay, am I going to continue to support myself through, you know, graphic design or something else, or am I going to go into kind of full-time into making art? And, you know, it was a time when I made, like, several very brave steps. One of them was to let go of, you know, of this stable job, and the other was to kind of, you know, really take a more definitive step into New York and into, you know, being here and making art here. And interestingly enough, I think the Momentum, this exhibition in Norway, was a very high profile exhibition with a lot of, you know, it's a very large Nordic biennial with a lot of public attention, and I somehow expected that this was like going to be a very major, you know, step for me, which it was. But interestingly enough, there wasn't really anything that happened immediately following. And I was very kind of nervous about this. And this is, I think, my sort of word of wisdom to maybe to other artists in the same situations, is that, you know, that was such, when I look back, I think of this as a time that was so important, because I really had the peace of mind, and I had the uninterrupted time in my studio to really make work and not think so much in, I was not so exhibition focused, you know, during this period of time, because there weren't really that many exhibitions that were coming up for me. And then I was traveling in Germany in 2002, and I ran into a curator that I met in Norway. His name is Gjotto Del Vecchio, and he used to have a gallery in Naples for many years, and now has a gallery in Berlin called Suportico Lopez. And he was there with a friend of his named Luca, and Luca and I began talking, and then, you know, a couple of days later, Luca invited me to a party, and then I went back to New York, and Luca and I kept writing each other, and then within a couple of weeks, there was an invitation from Luca to exhibit my work in Artissima, in the booth of his gallery in Artissima, and that was in 2002, and that was sort of the beginning of my sort of entry into the gallery world, you could say. And this is a gallery that was in Torino called Galleria Maze, and I showed to them for several years. They took my work to Lister and Basel and to several places, and that was sort of then, in another way, a beginning of another sort of phase in my career. I think that, especially because that wasn't until 2002, 2003, I think that people often, you know, are under the impression that that was the beginning of my work, but at that time I'd really been showing and, you know, working, but more sort of outside of the sort of market or commercial context since 1995.
It's been really wonderful talking with you, Katrin. I'd like to ask you one more question or comment, perhaps, which is, you know, a lot of artists are listening to this of all ages, not just younger artists, mid-career artists, older artists. Is there anything you want to leave them in terms of an artist talking to other artists, anything about process or stages in career? Everyone who's listening to this, you know, more than likely has an interest in the art world, in producing work. They'd love to represent their own country, do all kinds of things. Is there anything you want to leave with them in particular?
Yes, I mean, I think that I think it's just important to always notice, you know, the opportunity in all, you know, in every different situation and in every different outcome in one's you know, professional life. I think it's very, very important to have a good network of friends and peers that are making art, and to understand, you know, the gift in every, you know, in every outcome. I mean, sometimes I've had exhibitions in the past where I've had, you know, some of my first exhibitions, there were maybe, you know, 10 or 15 people that would come and see them, you know. But sometimes it's just the appreciation and the right understanding of one or two people who really, you know, can give you the type of, you know, satisfaction and the lead going forward that you need. And I also think that the most important thing an artist can do is is to be really faithful and truthful in their work and in their process. And I think for people who are trying to, you know, further their career and becoming more successful, I mean, it can never be overstated just the importance of focusing on the work itself, focusing on one's own practice in the studio. And I think in my you know, that's in the end, you know, it's the axis that everything else, you know, turns around.
Katrin, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.